And the Georgetown Lecture Fund. When people say this is the most important election in my lifetime, whether they're a student at Georgetown or whether they're your grandfather, they are literally correct. Because there's so much at stake. The physical security of our children, the retirement security of our parents, the economic and health security of our families, and above all else, the national security of our country, which after all is the President of the United States' first responsibility. I start from a very simple and basic premise in today's speech. We cannot afford another 4 years of Republican stewardship of our national security. After 8 years of the Bush administration, I believe it is not hyperbole to suggest that the United States of America is less secure and more isolated than it has been at any time in recent American history. This administration has dug us through its policies into a very deep hole, with very few friends around the world to help us climb out. But it doesn't have to be that way. For I believe, and I believed in my abortive effort to get the nomination, that the next President of the United States has an awesome responsibility, but the next President of the United States has the greatest opportunity since Franklin Delano Roosevelt, not only to change the face of America, but literally not figuratively, to change the direction of the world. Not make it a utopia, but to change the direction of the world. We're at just such an intersection. But it all must start, in my view, with a much clearer understanding of how profoundly the world has changed in the last two decades. For example, when Bill Clinton, a graduate of this great university, was sworn in to be President of the United States in 1992, there were a total of 1.2 billion fewer people in the world competing for the jobs Americans held. When the price of oil in 1992 was $28 a barrel, it is now $113 a barrel. So-called sovereign wealth funds that are literally bailing out the biggest investment banking houses in the United States, in the world. These sovereign wealth funds today represent $2.5 trillion of money that didn't exist at the time. And by the year 2018, they'll represent $17.5 trillion of leverage in the world. As I said, the global workforce has doubled since the end of the Cold War, from 1 billion to 2.3 billion people. To quote one of my favorite Irish poets, William Butler Yeats, he said in a poem called Easter 1916, referring to his Ireland, he said, "The world has changed utterly. A terrible beauty has been born." The world has changed utterly, and our foreign policy has failed to reflect how fundamental and consequential these changes are. The emergence of China and India as major economic powers, the resurgence of Russia floating on a sea of oil revenues exceeding anyone's expectation, a unifying Europe that looks at the United States with dismay, a spread of dangerous weapons and lethal disease, a shortage of secure sources of energy, water, and even food. The incredible impact of climate change has become so obvious even to the most skeptical of people in the last decade. The rising wealth in the world and the persistent poverty, and how wide that gap continues to grow. A technological revolution that sends people, ideas, and money around the world at even faster speeds. The challenge to nation states from ethnic and sectarian cleansing strife, the struggle between modernity and extremism, which I believe is at the heart of the struggle of 1.2 billion Muslims in the world. That's just a short list of the forces that you are studying, but also that they're shaping the 21st century. To state the obvious, No one country can control these forces. But more than any other country in the world, we have the capacity, we have the possibility of impacting on these changes. But it requires us to use the totality of our strength. Our military and economic prowess and resources are necessary, but they are not sufficient to lead us into and through this new century. It's our ideas and our ideals that will allow us to exert the kind of leadership that persuades other nations to follow and allows us to more effectively deal with these forces of change that I referenced. Over the past few months, over the next few weeks, I will speak in detail about how Democrats will exert that kind of leadership. But for today, I want to concentrate on this administration and to draw the stark distinction as it relates to the choices that face you, the American people, between now and November. For I believe this administration, with which I have attempted to work, and I would suggest this and let the press and the dean and others make their own judgment, I have tried very hard to work with the administration on these areas. But I believe it has squandered our ability to shape this new world. It has put virtually all of these issues on the back burner that I mentioned, failing to devote the intellectual capital and the consistent and constant effort they require. I believe it has destroyed faith in America's judgment around the world, and it has devalued America's leadership around the world. Instead, this administration is focused, in my view, to the point of obsession, on the so-called war on terror, or they pronounce it war on terrorism. It has produced a one-size-fits-all doctrine of military preemption and regime change, ill-suited for the challenges we face. It has made fear the main driver of our foreign policy. I believe it has turned a deadly serious but manageable threat, that is a small number of radical groups that hate America, into a 10-foot-tall existential monster that dictates literally every move that this administration makes. Even if you look at the world through the prism of this administration, through its own distorted lens, I believe judging it by its own standards, its national strategic policy has failed. This failure flows from a dangerous combination of ideology and incompetence and a profound confusion about whom we are fighting. My fellow Americans, I think it starts with the very language that the President of the United States 6 years ago has tried to impose. And that is, this is a global war on terror. That statement is simply inaccurate. Terrorism is a means, not an end. And very different groups and countries are using it toward very different goals and objectives. If you can't even identify the enemy or describe the war we're fighting, it's pretty difficult to figure out how we're going to win that war. The most urgent threat, in my view, is the intersection of the world's most dangerous groups like Al-Qaeda with the world's most lethal weapons. But we also must confront groups that use terror not to target us directly, but to advance their own nationalistic causes. We must deal with outlaw states that support them and otherwise flout the rules. We must face the civil war in Iraq, a renewed war in Afghanistan, and an ideological war over the future of Pakistan. And we must help resolve the historic conflict. Between the Arabs and the Israelis. And in my view, we must contend with Iran, especially its efforts to acquire the capacity to build nuclear weapons, but contend with it in a rational way. This administration has spent 5 years fixated on changing the Iranian regime. No one likes the regime. But think about the logic of regime change. It goes like this. Iran, renounce the bomb, and when you do, we're still going to take you down. Let me say it again. That's literally the logic of regime change. Renounce the very thing that may keep us from invading you or attacking you or destabilizing you. And when you do, your reward will be we will still take down the regime. The result is that Iran has accelerated its efforts to produce fissile material and is closer to the bomb now than it was before George Bush took office. Instead of regime change, we should focus on conduct change. We should make it very clear to Iran what it risks in terms of isolation if it continues to pursue a dangerous nuclear weapons program, but also what it stands to gain if it does the right thing. To do that will require keeping our allies in Europe as well as in Russia and China on the same page as we, the world, ratchets up pressure on Iran. But it also means doing much more to reach out to Iran, including through direct talks to exploit the cracks within the ruling elite and between the Iranian rulers and its people. Its people who are struggling economically and stifled politically. The Iranian people need to know that their government, not the United States of America, is the one choosing confrontation over cooperation. Saber rattling with regard to Iran, in my view, has been the most self-defeating policy imaginable. What is its effect? It forces Iranians who despise the regime to rally behind the regime. And it spurs the inability in the Middle East, which adds to the price of oil, with the proceeds going right into Tehran's pocket. Oil experts talk about the security premium in oil. That ranges anywhere from 15 to 30% of the price of oil. That is the fear of an outbreak of a regional war causing a further disruption sends the price of oil even higher. So what does our saber rattling do? Instead of giving Ahmadinejad $50 billion to have in his pocket to do bad things, if that's what he's doing, it gives him $110 billion in his pocket to do bad things. The worst nightmare for a regime that thrives on isolation and tension, in my view, is an American ready and willing to engage it. It's amazing to me how little faith this administration has in the power of America's ideas and ideals. All those fronts throughout the Middle East and South Asia are connected. There's a tendency in this administration, and even among some Democrats, to view each of these fronts in splendid isolation, as if Iran does an impact on Afghanistan, impact on Iraq, in the Middle East, etc. You cannot view each of these areas in splendid isolation. But this administration, in my view, like some Democrats, has wrongly conflated them under one label and has argued that success on one front ensures victory on all fronts. It has lumped together as a single threat the extremist groups and states, many times more at odds with one another than they are at odds with us. But nonetheless, it lumps them together as one and the same. It has picked the wrong fights at the wrong time, failing to finish a necessary war in Afghanistan before starting a war of choice in Iraq. The result is, to quote the findings of what they call the NIE, the National Intelligence Estimates, that's the collective findings of roughly 13 intelligence agencies in the United States of America. To quote the NIE, quote, Al-Qaeda is better positioned to strike the West. It has regenerated, and it remains determined to attack us here at home. End of quote. That's not Joe Biden, a Democrat. That's the national security establishment that works for the President of the United States of America. Of course, we must deal with and destroy Al-Qaeda. But instead of rolling back the threat it poses, this administration approach has helped produce a global breakout of extremism, which now threatens more people in more places than it did before 9/11. So even on its own terms, the national security strategy of this administration has been a failure. And I'd respectfully suggest we cannot afford four more years of this policy. Last month, a man I greatly admire, a man who I consider a personal and close friend, Senator John McCain, set out his vision for America's foreign policy. To his credit, which I know you're never supposed to acknowledge in this political climate when a Republican does something good, in my view, to his credit, some of what John said was a stark repudiation of the Bush administration's approach to the world. For John recognizes that the power of our example is as important as the example of our power. That allies respect, that we respect, not disdain, can help advance our interest. And he is especially eloquent about his abhorrence for war, as John is uniquely placed to be. But John McCain remains wedded to the Bush administration's myopic view of a world defined by terrorism. He would continue to allow a tiny minority, as I understand John's positions, to set the agenda for the overwhelming majority. Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for a change in the administration's worldview. It's time for a fundamental change, but that's going to require more than a great soldier. It's going to require a wise leader. And nowhere is that truer than in dealing with the most urgent necessity we have, Iraq. The war dominates our national life. It sits like a boulder in the middle of the road, preventing us from having the credibility to lead the world and the flexibility to deal with our problems at home. When it comes to Iraq, there's no daylight between John McCain and George Bush. They're joined at the hip. When it comes to Iraq, there will be no change with the McCain administration. And so, there is a real and profound choice for Americans in November. For I'll reiterate what I said. Unless we deal with Iraq, we do not have the ability to regain the confidence of the rest of the world who we need to deal with these other problems, nor do we have the resources and the flexibility to deal with the problems at home. How many of you believe we can continue to spend $125 billion a year for the foreseeable future and have a national health care policy? How many of you believe we can radically amend our attitude toward education in America for a 21st century education policy and continue to spend indefinitely $125 billion a year in Iraq? Ladies and gentlemen, like President Bush, Senator McCain likes to talk about the dire consequences of drawing down American forces in Iraq. He argues that Iraq is the meeting point of the two greatest threats America faces, in his view, Al-Qaeda and Iran. After all, it's ironic if the argument they use is the most, is just chock full of irony, Iraq and Iran. After all, who opened Iraq's doors to Al-Qaeda and Iran? The Bush administration. Al-Qaeda in Iraq is a Bush-fulfilling prophecy. It wasn't there before the war, but it's there now. And as to Iran, its influence went from 0 to 60 when we toppled Saddam's Sunni regime and gave Shiite religious parties, inspired and nurtured by Iran, a path to power. No matter how we got to this point, Presidents Bush and Senator McCain argued that if we start to leave in earnest, it will further empower Al-Qaeda and Iran. I believe, with many other leading figures in American diplomacy and military, I believe they've got it exactly backwards. The large number of very prominent retired military and national security experts who testified before my committee last month also share that view. So we have to ask ourselves some questions about their premise, that if we begin to seriously draw down, will we destabilize this whole region? Will Al-Qaeda regain force and new power to strike us? Will Iran's influence significantly increase? Well, we have to ask some questions. Would drawing down really strengthen Al-Qaeda and give it a launching pad to attack America? Or, as many former generals and national security experts have said, would it help eliminate what little indigenous Iraqi support Al-Qaeda in Iraq retains? Most Sunni Arabs have turned on Al-Qaeda in Iraq, alienated by their tactics and ideology. And the Shia hate Al-Qaeda, who are Sunnis. And the Kurds hate Al-Qaeda. Nobody in Iraq likes Al-Qaeda. So why is it thriving to the extent it is? Because it's a useful tool, it has been in the recent past, for the Sunnis to join with to kill Americans. So you have to ask the question, if we really drew down significantly, would it atrophy or would it be emboldened? Al-Qaeda in Iraq is down to about 2,000 Iraqis and a small number of foreigners whose almost exclusive focus is Iraq. When we draw down, I would argue the most likely result is that Iraqis of all confessions will stamp out its remnants, and we can retain a residual force in or near Iraq to help them finish that job relative to Al-Qaeda. Last week, I asked our ambassador in the celebrated hearings, because it was the end of the surge, or at least the next phase of the surge, a very competent and honorable man. His name is Ryan Crocker. I asked him in a direct question, and he gave me an honest, direct answer. I said, "Mr. Ambassador, tell us whether Al-Qaeda poses a greater threat to American security as a consequence of being in Iraq or in Afghanistan and Pakistan." And he said clearly, "Afghanistan and Pakistan." So what about Al-Qaeda in Pakistan and Afghanistan? The people who actually attacked us on 9/11. We know where they live. We know where they are. We know who they are. I recently got back from there. I almost got a chance to meet them. Our helicopter went down in the mountains. It's literally, unfortunately. And got stuck, Ben, on a 9,000-foot mountaintop. And we were just hopeful we were not in their neighborhood. But all kidding aside, we know where Al-Qaeda lives. We know where bin Laden is. He is not in Iraq. And our preoccupation with Iraq has made it physically impossible for us to provide the resources to Afghanistan and our efforts in Pakistan to deal with Al-Qaeda. If we draw down, would they really be emboldened? Or to paraphrase a national intelligence estimate on terrorism, would they lose one of their most effective recruiting tools? The notion that we're in Iraq to stay with permanent military bases and control over their oil. That's how they recruit. And would they finally risk the full measure of America's might if we drew down and focused on where they live? Senator McCain has taken a lot of heat for saying he would not mind if American troops stayed in Iraq for 100 years. Again, not my business as a strong supporter of the Democratic candidates to defend John McCain. What he was doing was trying to explain, to make an analogy to our long-term presence in peaceful post-war Germany, post-armistice Korea, and post-Dayton Bosnia. But Germany, Korea, and Bosnia, after the peace, are nothing like Iraq today, where there is no peace. Iraq, with thousands of bombs, hundreds of Americans injured, dozens of Americans killed every month, even after the surge and the violence has come down. And there is little prospect that Iraq will look anything like Germany, Korea, or Bosnia anytime soon. Worse, saying you're happy to stay in Iraq for 100 years fuels the exact kind of dangerous conspiracy theories, the urban legend of the Middle East, about America's intentions throughout the Arab and Muslim worlds that we should in fact be working to dispel. Now, what about the second great threat that propels John and this administration's foreign policy? Iran. Would drawing down increase its already huge influence in Iraq? Or would it shift the burden of helping to stabilize Iraq from us to them and make our forces a much more credible deterrent to Iran's wider misbehavior if it took flight? The idea that we could or even should wipe out every single vestige of influence in Iraq is not only a fantasy, it is geographically needy. Ladies and gentlemen, they have shared a border, a significant border, for thousands of years. Even with 140,000 American troops in Iraq, our ally in Baghdad greets Iran's leader with kisses on both cheeks. If we cannot dispel Iranian influence at a moment when we're spending $3 billion a week, when we've lost over 4,000 American lives, over 30,000 wounded, we're the only raison d'etat why the Prime Minister of Iraq sits in Baghdad. And in that context, he invites the dreaded leader from Tehran, welcomes him with an embrace and a kiss on both cheeks, and every confessional group does the same. So much for our ability to fundamentally dispel any influence Iran may have on its neighbor, Iraq. I facetiously asked, I don't recall whether or not Maliki kissed the vice president on both cheeks. I don't recall. But right now, the facts are, ladies and gentlemen, Iran loves the status quo. With 140,000 troops bogged down and bleeding, caught in the crossfire, an intra-Shia rivalry, and a Sunni-Shia civil war. The challenge for us is not eliminating all of Iran's influence in Iraq, but forcing Iran to confront the specter of a disintegrating Iraq or an all-out war between the Shia factions. Neither prospect could they warmly embrace. By drawing down, we can take away Iran's ability to wage a proxy war, as the president says, against our troops. And we can force Tehran to concentrate on avoiding the turmoil inside Iraq's borders and the instability beyond them if, in fact, things break completely out of control. Finally, would a responsible drawdown, as is argued, accelerate sectarian chaos? Or to cause Iraqi's leaders and Iraqi Sunni Arab neighbors to finally begin to act more responsibly? To date, both have used our large presence as a crutch or an excuse for inaction. When that stops, they'll have to start to fill the vacuum or put their own vital interest much more keenly at risk than they are now. We should be debating the consequences of a more rational and rapid drawdown. They are arguable, as I have just laid out. But more importantly, we should talk about what both President Bush and Senator McCain refused to acknowledge: the increasing intolerable cost of staying in Iraq at the levels we are now. The risks of drawing down are debatable, and some of you really talented students could debate with me whether or not the assertions made by other generals and foreign policy specialists, some of which I just cited, are more or less credible than those made by John McCain and George Bush. But the cost of staying with 140,000 troops in Iraq are knowable, and they get steeper every day. The continued loss of lives and limbs of our soldiers, the emotional and economic strain on our troops and their families due to repeated extended tours, as the Army Chief of Staff and former commander in Iraq, General Casey, has repeatedly told Congress, he's repeatedly told us that we're about to break the United States military. We cannot sustain this level of commitment. How about the drain on our treasury? $12 billion every month going to the issues that many of you may think might better see that money. Maybe even reducing the deficit which you are going to inherit and have to pay. How about the impact on the readiness of our armed forces? Tying down so many combat battalions that the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the Army, General Cody, said, "We don't have any left over, any combat brigades left over to deal with any other emergency in the world." He said, and I'm paraphrasing, "We have never been in recent history in such difficulty as we are now in terms of military preparedness." How about the inability to send enough soldiers to the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan, where, as I said, Al-Qaeda really lives and really is still plotting to do great harm to our homeland? I was there last month, and when I visited Afghanistan and Pakistan, I met in Kabul with a very tough general named McNeil, who commands so-called ISAF, the International Force. And he told me that things are going badly in the south. In the south, in Helmand province and others, Taliban is gaining significant strength, as you read in the paper every day. It is moving back in. He said, "Senator, with two combat brigades, that's roughly 10,000 troops, I can straighten that out so we can begin to nail down this political settlement. But guess what?" He said, "I know I can't get them because they're in Iraq. There's nothing I can do about it." I asked another leading general, the number two man in the military, I said, "What does that mean?" He said, "It means more Americans will die. It will take longer to resolve the question. We'll ultimately think we'll be able to do it, but it's going to kick the can down the road a couple of years." Why? We have no residual force outside of what we have committed to Iraq. Even if we do pull troops out of Iraq, as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mullen, and others would like to do, when I asked Admiral Mullen in person what that would mean, would he send them to Afghanistan where they need, he said, "No, I couldn't do that, Senator." He said, "I'd have to send them home for rest and retraining." Paraphrasing, we're breaking them, even if we have a significant drawdown. So, folks, the longer we stay in Iraq, the more we put off the day when we can fully join the fight against the real Al-Qaeda threat and finally defeat those who attacked us, and also shore up our military as well as strategic needs around the world. Folks, it's long past time to clearly define our interest in Iraq, and it's not in our interest to intervene in an internal power struggle among Shiite factions. It's not in our interest to back one side or the other and get caught in the crossfire of a Sunni-Shia civil war. But it is in our interest to start to leave Iraq in real numbers without leaving chaos behind, and it is possible. Even if we could keep 140,000 troops in Iraq, they're not going to be the deciding factor on preventing the chaos everybody fears. Instead, we need to focus all our remaining energy and initiatives on achieving what virtually everyone agrees is the key to stability in Iraq: a political power-sharing arrangement among the warring factions. I remain convinced, as I did years ago, that the only path towards such a settlement is through a decentralized federal Iraq that brings resources and responsibilities down to the local and regional levels. And I might add, parenthetically, the only success we've had in Iraq thus far is when we do that. When we do that. We need a diplomatic surge to get the world's major powers, Iraq's neighbors, and the Iraqis themselves to invest in a sustainable political settlement. 15 months into this surge that President Bush ordered and John McCain embraced, we've gone from drowning to treading water. And we're no closer to the president's stated goal for the surge, which was for an Iraq that can defend itself, govern itself, and sustain itself in peace. And we're still spending $3 billion a week, suffering hundreds of casualties a month, and losing still 30 to 40 American lives every month. We cannot keep treading water without exhausting ourselves, and more importantly, doing great damage to our other vital interests around the world and at home. And that's exactly what President Bush and President McCain would be asking us to do. They can't tell us when or even if Iraqis will come together politically, for they have no plan for them either, which was the purpose of the surge in the first place. They can't tell us when or even if we'll draw down below the pre-surge levels. They can't tell us when or even if Iraq will be able to stand on its own 2 feet. And they can't tell us when or even if this war will end. What I find most offensive is they suggest that those, not John, but the president, suggest that those who disagree with this strategy are either weak or willing to surrender. I love this phrase, surrender, we're using. Ladies and gentlemen, the vast majority of Americans want this war to end. They want us to come together around a plan to leave Iraq without leaving chaos behind. And I'm here to tell you flat out, the American people who want that to happen are not defeatists. They are patriots who understand our overall national interest and the great things America can achieve if we responsibly end this war, a war we should never have started in the first place. I believe it's fully within our power to do that, just that, leave and leave responsibly. Then, with our credibility restored, our alliances repaired, and our freedom renewed, we'll once again be able to engage the world and lead, for no one has that capacity now. We'll once again address the hopes, not play in the fears, of our fellow Americans. That's my hope for next November and for the country we all love. Ladies and gentlemen, it sounds corny, but I mean it when I say it, and I don't say it often. May God bless this country, for my grandfather Finnegan used to say, his name was Ambrose Finnegan, he said, "Joey, there's two things God always protects, drunk Irishmen and America." Well, let me tell you something. Pray God my grandpop was right. But most importantly, may God protect our troops, because as I speak, they're dying. As I speak. Thank you for listening.